right here at RPI in the studio live with Sharav Astral. And Sharav Astral is an assistant professor in the STS program here, Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. She's also the director of a public service internship here. And she has an interest and has researched menstruation, the technologies around menstruation and feminine hygiene. She's a specialist in the history of medicine, the history of sexuality, and she's published a number of things. One item coming up, an article, I think, or a chapter, Masking Menstruation, the Emergence of Menstrual Hygiene Products in the United States, and a book that's coming out that she's working on, Red Marks, Menstruation, Menstrual Hygiene Product, and Women's Rights in the United States. And I will have her take it from here. Shara, welcome to Talking History.
Thank you very much.
I was wondering, this is a topic that I've not heard discussed very much in radio, and I've certainly haven't heard it covered in history shows, not that there are many history shows, so it's a pleasure to cover it here on Talking History. How did you get interested in studying feminine hygiene and the technology around it?
Well, I've always been interested in just what people do every day, sort of their everyday mundane lives. In a former life, I was a park ranger, and so I would talk a lot about just everyday history. And sort of as I was looking for a dissertation project and something to write about, I started thinking about women's history and what did women do on the Oregon Trail when they had their periods? It was a very sort of simple question. What did slave women do when they were out in the fields? And so I started poking around and realized that mostly they folded up rags. They folded up gauze or things like flannel and pinned things to their undergarments and really just had it was a technology in some ways, but it was a very rudimentary sort of thing. And so the more I looked at that, the more I realized that the sale of menstrual hygiene products was a really big transition. And this happened in the 1920s. And there were a lot of things that were being sold new in the 1920s, like ivory soap and Gillette razors. And there was this new sort of fixation about hygiene. You didn't want to have a stinky body. You wanted to be presentable. It was also part of being American. When European immigrants would come to the United States, when they, you know, were freshly new, you could smell the difference between people who were using, you know, ivory soap and they weren't. So this sort of fascination with hygiene, the rise of a commercial society, all sort of come together when we look at menstrual hygiene products as well. So I realized it was very ripe for doing a historical analysis.
Before we go on with that, I'm just curious as to, there's been a lot of writing about the human body and the technologies around the human body, and I know a lot of the postmodernists have been focusing on that. Were you influenced by any of that literature?
A little bit, but I think theory is very useful, but to me, it's the examples that people can identify with that are most significant. So it's important to have both the theory and the stuff. And so I was really interested in the stuff. And also just the other reason I was interested in it is because, you know, we don't really talk about menstrual hygiene. And even in the ads, even now, you know, they'll just show it's this representation and metaphor and symbol, and it's not really the product that's shown. So it's a very strange thing that you would sell something that you don't actually show in an advertisement, which is exactly true in the 1920s. They didn't even mention what it was for. So, the body technologies and literature about body technologies did influence me, but I'm also just interested in really everyday people and how they go about their lives.
Now, the transition from this makeshift technology, the use of rags in the 19th century, to the marketing of products,
right,
around it, that from reading some of the material that you sent me ahead of time, that really began in the late 19th century, even before the 1920s.
Yeah, there was an abysmal campaign to sell a product called Lister's Towels. And Listerine, obviously, was on the market, and Listerine helped to kill germs. And so Lister's Towels were sort of an outshoot of this. And you could buy those in, like, Sears and Roebuck's catalog. You could mail order them, but it really didn't catch on. People
weren't... Sears and Roebuck?
Yeah, online. You could
how
buy...
Do they how do they sell it?
Well,
how do they advertise?
The catalog, you could buy anything from Sears. There were these small little print pictures in the back, and you could buy... Oh, gosh... Yeah, you could buy the Lister's towels. They also sold these horrible products called rubber bloomers that you could wear, and you would pull up these rubber bloomers to protect yourself from your menstrual blood and your petticoats or your skirts. There were rubber aprons that you could buy. So there were all sorts of menstrual paraphernalia, but nothing that women really... You know, it didn't work much better than the regular old rags. And so the real difference was that the technologies improved. And so during World War I, Kimberly-Clark Corporation, which we now know makes like diapers and Kleenex and things like that, they were making bandages for soldiers during the war. And sort of crafty nurses during the war started folding them up during their periods and using them, and it worked great. It was absorbent, it was softer, it was disposable, and so they wrote letters back to Kimberly-Clark Corporation and said, this is, you know, you need to start making something out of these, you need to start making some menstrual hygiene products, and they did. And so the problem was they had, you know, they'd purchased thousands and thousands of acres of timber. And you don't have bleeding soldiers after the war, so it was an opportune moment for them to try to produce other paper-based disposable products. And so that's what they did. The next step, though, was how do you get it out to the public? How do you talk about bleeding?
Well, before we get into that, it's fascinating. I'm going to ask you a lot of questions.
Okay.
I don't know if you're going to answer them, but it just raises... Was this an example, though, I mean, with at World War I and the development of this early technology?
Yeah.
But within Kimberly-Clark, were there women working on this, or were there men developing products for women?
It was mostly men. Mm-hmm. Certainly there were women in support capacity as secretaries and things like that, but mm-hmm. No, it was mostly male engineers at this point and male production of what they thought women would use.
Mm-hmm.
So, for some people later down the line, they say that that was one of the biggest problems, that it was men designing something for women because they didn't really know what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, during the late teens and the early 20s, when the products were being developed, it was male engineers.
So in the early development, but later on there would be women
yes,
involved
there were.
In that?
Okay. Yes.
So let's move forward then with this product. What happens next?
Well, once the big hurdle was how to advertise the product, and there was a push to advertise it in Ladies' Home Journal, and Kimberly-Clark had to prove that it would be done in a tasteful and tactful way, and that it wouldn't turn off any of its readers. So once they opened the door into Ladies' Home Journal, they did this through really beautiful artwork. I mean, I've seen some of the original, almost poster-sized pieces, and it's just this luscious sort of watercolor. It's very pretty. There's flowing skirts. So it's nothing to sort of... indicate that it would be about a bleeding or a mess or anything like that. So the ads were supposed to appeal to a very sort of high sensibility. The pads were very expensive. They were about, one pad was about the same price as a loaf of bread. So it was a luxury to a lot of women. So they sold it as an upper class product, and that you could aspire to purchase this, and that this would help. You know, if you could buy sanitary napkins, it also was a level of your financial wherewithal and standing in society.
So this is just the middle class buying it. The poor were still using rags
and washing them. And even in the first ads, it would say solves the laundress problem, so that your Irish washerwoman or whoever, you know, your servant is no longer having to wash out your rags. You can just toss it in the trash.
So, in selling it, in what were the obstacles? Obviously, there appears to be this attitude towards blood and women's blood. Could you talk a little bit about that? About the attitude towards menstruation that men and women had, and you know, relationship to the products themselves.
Well, there's issues of public and private. And so, you know, a lot of private bodily things we don't like to have advertised. And, you know, we sell all sorts of things like toilet paper and Kleenex and, Tucks for hemorrhoids. I mean, there's a lot of things that are advertised, but we don't necessarily like to have that publicly announced to the world. Our, you know, our private bathroom toiletries are not sort of open for everyone. So the sort of question is, how do you make this public without sort of turning people's stomachs in some ways? So with most of those ads, you know, it talks about, I mean, whether it's Gillette razors or soap, it's how to improve yourself, how to make yourself better, and how the commodities will actually improve your life. And so, you know, the ads are definitely pushing toward the sort of better life, upward mobility, things like that. And in some ways it worked because people were interested in improving themselves. There certainly are taboos, there were concerns, but the concerns were not so much about Kotex and sanitary napkins as they were more about tampons. Sanitary napkins were developed in the 20s. Tampons were sold in the really the 30s is when they began. 1936 is when Tampax hit the market. And so, you know, the issues are different, obviously, for those two different kinds of products. But one woman who really worked to, well, revolutionize the way the products were sold was Lillian Gilbreth. And Lillian Gilbreth was an efficiency expert. And she and her husband are better known for the book Cheaper by the Dozen, and there have been a couple movies, remakes from that book. But she had 12 children, and she and her husband would go around to different industrial sites, and they would follow people as they put the cogs and bolts together and try to figure out what was the shortest distance between their steps and how to make things the quickest for improved industrial production.
And this is continuing the work of Frederick Taylor in the scientific management.
Exactly. School. And so she and her husband were a team in this. And he died very suddenly in 1924,
I think.
Yeah. And so here she is with 12 children, with a PhD in psychology, actually, from Brown. And she needs to support her family. And so she sort of sets out to start, to keep doing these efficiency studies. But it's hard as a woman, you know, they don't trust her as much without Frank. And she gets a break from Johnson & Johnson because they're trying to sell a new product called Modess. Because it's modest. You're modest if you use Modess.
No, I thought it was pronounced modest, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so Modess is not doing as well as Kotex. The ads aren't as pretty. They're just, it's sort of hobbling along, and they've had this horrible, they've just had horrible success. So they hire Lillian, and they hire Lillian because they've been getting letters from women, and the women are saying, you know, you need to do something about your product. They chafe my legs. I mean, people would get really large sort of sores and scrapes and welts on their legs from the gauze, which was very rough. So they were, you know, they were uncomfortable. They were big. You could see them through your pants and your underwear. And people were writing saying, you know, you need to make these smaller. You need to make them flushable. You say they're flushable, but they back up my toilet. You know, I can't really flush them. And in fact, the directions would say you have to take the pad apart and like rip out the insides of the pad and flush sections of the, you know, this huge pad down the toilet. So it wasn't flushable. They weren't really that great. And so Johnson & Johnson hired her to do a survey. No one had done a survey to find out what women wanted. I mean, they were getting these letters, but it was not a systematic, organized sort of thing. So Lillian goes out, and she has two other women. She sends out surveys all over the place. She sends them out to women's colleges. She sends them out to, you know, the laundry services. She sends them out to bakeries. I mean, she's sending them out all over the place. And what comes back is that women are making their own. They're taking the disposable pads and modifying them to fit their own bodies and their own needs. They want something that's smaller. They want something that's more compact. they're sick of like the rubber bloomers. And then also there's a whole group that say, well, I don't even buy them because I can make my own better. And this is horrible news for Johnson & Johnson that their products aren't being sold. But then they also take it and say, okay, well, what are we going to do? We need to make something better.
From the material you sent me, it's fascinating to find that she really targeted young women.
Yeah.
Not women in their 30s or 40s,
right.
But the college-age women.
Right.
Could you explain that to our listeners?
Well, you know, certainly through the teens and the 20s, there was the rise of the new woman, the woman who has cut her hair, and is sort of the idea that she's shed some of her mother's Victorian notions of sexuality and education. There's more women in college during the 1920s than there are during the 1950s. So there's this whole rise of women who are trying to break away from their families or their former lives. They're trying to apply their college educations. And so there's a sense that younger people are more willing to try new things. And so these new, and also buy things. I mean, they're part of the new commercial youth market. So that if you direct it toward women and young women, especially college women who are supposedly learning and trying out these new things, that they will be more likely to become lifelong consumers. And that's the thing that's really important for Johnson & Johnson and Kimberly-Clark, even still today, that if you can get them early enough, that they will maintain their product allegiance throughout their whole menstrual lives.
In your writing, you emphasize the Johnson & Johnson and other companies appropriating feminism to sell these products to women. I thought that was a fascinating part of your argument.
Yeah, well, you know, feminism is really threatening in a lot of ways in the 20s. You know, the women's movement is really pretty strong through the teens and the early 20s. Women get the right to vote. There's a push to get ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, passed, which ultimately never gets passed. But there's a fear, you know. I mean, for some women, it's wonderful. For other women, this is just a horrible shake of society. But, you know, what are these expectations? But what's really interesting about the ads is that they do appropriate this language of freedom. They appropriate the idea that you can have freedom of body, freedom of movement, you can travel, you can do all of these things that you might not be able to do, because the other sort of taboo that's at work is that if you're having cramps or, you know, bleeding or menstruating at all, that you should stay home. That the sort of common wisdom, the common advice given by physicians to people who could afford it was that you should stay in bed, you shouldn't go to school. And in fact, late 19th century mores thought that when you were studying, that all of your energy and vital force went to your head, and that if you were, you know, just if you were a young girl that was growing into maturity, that if all this energy was going to your head, there was none going down to your uterus or your ovaries, and so that you were creating infertile women by the very creation of their studying. So there were serious concerns about women in school and how strenuous their studies were. So this is lingering. It's falling away. I mean, there's other female physicians who are working hard to sort of break apart those taboos in the 1920s. But with the pads and the disposable pads, it shakes things up, because now, you know, you don't necessarily have to wear a rag. You don't, I mean, what do you do with a rag if you're out, if you're at school, you can't get back home, you can't do a bathroom. I mean, it's this thing you're lugging around. And so there really is a bodily freedom in some ways that the disposable products provide. And so companies, they latch on to sort of the safe aspects of feminism, but not the revolutionary aspects, which would be, you know, equal pay, you know, men and women staying home, taking care of children, you know, and all the things.
Yeah, it's very,
like that.
Very consistent with the arguments about what happened to feminism after the voting rights was achieved in the 1920s. It became much more oriented towards women as consumers.
Right.
And it's very
right.
Parallels that.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's just a very stark example in some ways of that specific thing that you're talking about.
So the so Gilbert gets involved in marketing and in analyzing the problems and the issues, and works with Johnson & Johnson and does these incredible surveys. I looked at her numbers, how scientific she was.
Yeah.
My God, she calculated that a woman in a normal lifespan used 4,576 napkins.
Yeah, she is. She's very specific. She's very exacting. And yeah, she looks at the number of periods, the number of pads, how many women are in the United States, and basically what she's telling Johnson & Johnson is, look, you've got this huge captive commercial consumer audience that you just haven't even tapped into, and you know it's a moneymaker. I mean, it's a cash cow. You know, they're crazy not to actually dip into it. And so they take her advice. they make different size pads. They start a whole new ad campaign. And yeah, Modess takes off. And it's not as successful as Kotex, but one of the things that they do based upon her ads is that some women, they say, are concerned about going to the store and telling the cashier that they want a box of napkins. Because in some stores, you'd have to tell someone and they would sort of go and retrieve the box for you at the pharmacy. It's not like going to a store now. And so Lillian found, well, before they had this really great advertisement from Modess, and there was a coupon. And at the bottom of the coupon, it said, you know, you were supposed to slide it over to the cashier and say, one box of Modess, please. So it just is this little piece of paper that says, one box, please. So you don't have to say anything. And then, so that was supposed to help you be less embarrassed when you bought a box of.
And did it work?
I think for some women it did, but the campaign was short-lived, so I think it didn't last very long. And in fact, that's what Lillian found, that women were not, that wasn't one of their hang-ups, that it was the size, it was the shape, it was, you know, other things. It wasn't actually going to the store. But Kotex would actually have the pharmacists wrap the boxes in newsprint, so that you could carry the boxes down the street and not, so that people wouldn't know you were bleeding. And I think this is a really weird thing, and the fascinating thing is that, like, it's natural, obviously, it's an organic process to have your period, yet you're supposed to hide it, cover it, and pretend that you're not really bleeding. So I've sort of tried to look at this as almost a similar act as in passing. I mean, usually we think of passing with light-skinned black people, or like trying to pass as white.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we think about it in terms of sexuality, with like cross-dressers passing as a different gender. And so I've took that idea of passing to even apply it to women's bodies and their health. And so that with the technology, it kind of helps you pass as being a normal woman, even though ironically it's normal to bleed. So it's there's very sort of oppositional things going on with the purchase and use of the tampons and napkins.
Do you see that changing, the attitude towards menstruation changing in the decades of the 20th century?
Well, what really I think helps to change things, I mean, certainly Lillian's studies help give us some evidence about what was happening in the 30s, but the thing that really changed was World War II. And the thing about World War II is that industries needed women workers. And the problem is that women workers are not men. They have babies. They bleed. They have all these things that men don't, their bodies don't necessarily do. I mean, not that men don't need breaks or other things, but that, you know, pregnancy does not allow you to stand on your feet for 8 or 10 hours a day on an assembly line. And so there was a whole group of industrial psychologists that came about and tried to get businesses and also women to change their attitudes about menstruation. And so these psychologists were studying menstruation. They were studying just really crazy things like irritability factors with knee jerk height. You know, when you hit the doctor hits your knee with a little hammer. Like, mm-hmm. However high your knee went, that was supposedly correlated to your your irritability. So they were studying rates of kleptomania in psychotic women during their periods. So there was this fascination with the effects of psychosomatic problems related to menstruation and what was a physiological problem related to menstruation. And so once they started saying, okay, well, there are things that women can control, they started creating programs to change people's attitudes about staying home, about feeling sick, calling in sick. Because the problem was, if you're on an assembly line, you don't want to have a hole. You don't want to have that part not produced. And so if women are saying they're sick and they have cramps, then that creates a problem on the assembly line. So industrial managers became very smart, and what they did was they hired female counselors, and the counselors dealt with all sorts of things. They dealt with how to find transportation to get women to work, how to find apartments for people who were coming into the cities to, you know, who wanted the work but didn't have a place to live, how to find daycare for their children, and also just how to keep the sanitary napkin bin filled in the bathroom. And so they would work with management to actually get a cot into the bathrooms. And you can see this, you can see bathroom architecture even now, that in women's bathrooms, there's often the area where the toilets are, and then there's the area where there's a couch or chairs or like a little...
Yeah, men are rarely allowed in there.
It's sort of
a mystery. I never know what's really going on.
Well, it sometimes is a mystery. But there is this architecture in many bathrooms, not all bathrooms, where there's a couch and a chair. And so the idea is that if you could just lie down for a little bit and maybe your cramps would pass, or if you took an aspirin, that you'd feel better in a couple hours instead of staying home, because that's more productive. You know, it's better for the company for you to be at work instead of at home. And so the managers were very interested in getting these counselors to help women sort of say, oh, you know what, I'm not sick. Menstruation's not pathological. It's not a sickness. It's not even a condition. It's just normal, and I can manage it. And so they taught them exercises. They taught them breathing. They taught them how to, you know, relax in some ways, so that they were reconditioning women in an effort to make them better workers. And so part of the result of this was also purchasing menstrual hygiene products. And so the ads reinforce this. The ads over and over again say, you know, you can be the fun in his furlough. Don't take a break when just because it's that time. And so there's, you know, the advertisements reinforce it. They and then posters up in the workplace will say, you know, lick absenteeism. Don't fall to the axis. So that, you know, missing a day's work equated to an unpatriotic act as well. So there's many different pressures in some ways for women to conform to a new model of menstrual health during the war, and the menstrual hygiene technologies, especially tampons, do help with that.
And what happens after the war? Is there a transfer? Well, in two directions. One, is there any work? This is not the question about what happens after the war, but is there anything done within the military for women in the military related to menstrual technology?
Yes, and that's a whole fascinating aspect too, because for industrial workers, you know, you can call in sick, and you don't always lose your job, but you do sort of have the luxury of calling in sick. For, you know, the women in the military, the Women's Auxiliary Corps, or the women in the Air Force, the Women Auxiliary Ferrying Division, the WAFs and the WAVES, they're on duty. They're part of the service. They can't just sort of call in sick, and just they can't stay in quarters. That's not part of the deal. And in fact, during the war, there was a great concern about women during their periods, about whether they were sharp enough, whether they could be trusted, whether they might faint while they were on duty. So there was a big question about how reliable women were during their periods. So they purposely were not put in, you know, highly sensitive or highly jobs that might put anyone at risk. And this was You could also see this in the Air Force, because there were many pilots who ferried cargo and things like that behind enemy lines. But there was a concern that there would be crashes, that they weren't very safe as pilots during their period. And so there was a rule, a no-fly rule, and women were supposed to be grounded from one day before their period until 2 days after, which is nearly a week or more than a week, you know, as if you're supposed to know when your period starts. How do you know that? And so they were supposed to just be grounded, and this caused a lot of problems, because how do you know when a person is in their period or not? And so, you know, some of the commanders would say, you know, it's really difficult unless we have the cooperation of the WAFs to know whether or not they would say she is in her period. And so even though there was this rule, they said there were a lot of subterfuges that, you know, people clearly continued flying. No, there weren't hundreds of crashes because of women's menstrual, you know, incapacity and things like that. So, you know, that was one place where you saw it in the military. The other place was that with the Women's Army Corps, if they had cramps, they were supposed to go to the infirmary. And the infirmary was a whole other sort of black hole, because you would stay until the cramps ended, but sometimes it took 2 or 3 days to be discharged from the infirmary. And so, you know, by that time, again, your period's nearly over. And so if you had this record of going to the infirmary, it was cause or grounds for dismissal. So it was, I mean, there were sort of ideological concerns about women in their periods and whether or not they could sort of be strong enough and be relied upon as soldiers in a lot of ways. And you know, I think there's sometimes that question still today. Can you know, Newt Gingrich asked that question, you know, that they're sick for one part of the month or something. Like, there was some quote where he was
I remember that debate over women in the military.
Yeah, and it
what position
came back down to their periods, combat. Whether or not you could trust them in the trenches because they're sick for part of the month. Yeah.
So I suspect that there's still a lot of work being done within the military about this issue.
Probably is. I haven't researched it. The current policy.
Well, it's fascinating story, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about it, and I'd love to have you back and explore some other aspects that we haven't explored here.
Okay,
so we will do that. We've been talking to Shara Bostrel, who is a historian of medicine and a historian of sexuality here at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and we've been talking about menstruation, the history of menstruation, and menstrual technologies.